This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. 50 years ago this week, President Lyndon Johnson signed Medicaid and Medicare into law as part of his ongoing war on poverty. Here's President Johnson during his 1964 State of the Union address.
Unfortunately, many Americans fell on the of hope. Some because of their poverty, and some because of their color, and all too many because of both. Our task is to help replace their despair with opportunity. And this administration today, here and now, declares unconditional war on poverty in America.
While poverty in America has not gone away, in 2013, Census Bureau data showed just over 45 million Americans still live in poverty. The lives of the poorest and the most vulnerable would be significantly worse without Medicaid, the healthcare system aimed at this population. Medicaid has grown to be the biggest provider of public health insurance, covering nearly 70 million people, most recently adding millions of previously uninsured through Obamacare. However, Medicaid has long been a target of politicians needing to slash budgets in areas that are not that likely to upset the middle class. Among the problems faced by Medicaid, difficulty in accessing medical care, in part because of low reimbursement rates for physicians. Today, Where We Live, we examine the history and the future of Medicaid. You can join us online at WNPR.org/Where We Live. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us in studio today is Rod Brembe. He's the commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Social Services. And Commissioner, welcome back to the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, John.
Also with us is Ellen Andrews, who's executive director of the Connecticut Health Policy Project. Ellen, welcome back.
Thank you.
Also joining us in studio today is Reverend Benita Grubbs, who's executive director of Christian Community Action in New Haven. Thank you so much for coming in, Reverend. I do appreciate it.
It's good to be here. Thank you, John.
And joining us by phone today is Alan Weil. He's editor-in-chief of Health Affairs, leading health policy journal in the U.S. He was former executive director for the Colorado Department of Healthcare Policy and Financing. Alan, welcome to our program. Thanks so much.
Pleasure to join you.
So first of all, Commissioner Brembe, I'd like to start with you as we listen to President Johnson, as we think back on, well, this year, 50-year anniversary of many, many things in America. Medicaid is one of them. Can you give us a sense from someone who works with this program on a daily basis how Medicaid has changed in this time, in these 50 years?
Great question, John. Medicaid has changed tremendously since the time that President Johnson launched it. I thought the quote that you used was brilliant in that he said it was an unconditional war on poverty. But Medicaid was launched as a poverty reduction program. It was also connected with welfare. If a person showed up for welfare, they got cash assistance and a card for medical services. That was Medicaid. No application, no enrollment. You simply got a card. But unfortunately, people were discouraged from using it. Over the last 50 years, Medicaid has grown. It has changed for the better because children were enrolled. So we began to take a look at our emerging population of children, making sure that they were well taken care of. Adults who were taking care of children were also added to Medicaid. And then most recently with the ACA, there was complete detachment from Medicaid or from welfare so that now we have a complete continuum so that people can access healthcare services through a marketplace, or they can fill out a single application to, again, be eligible for Medicaid through the typical or transitional Medicaid program.
Ellen, the changes to Medicaid over the years, do you see them largely as positive?
Yes, absolutely. Especially in Connecticut, I think we've got a lot to be proud of here, and partly because of the people I'm here in the room with. It is definitely – I remember back when it was linked to cash assistance and now it's the good old days. When it was really hard to find a provider, we were talking on the way up that a lot of the reasons that people didn't re-up – this is free health insurance. Why wouldn't you? Because they never could see anybody. That's not true anymore. It's become a proper, very sophisticated health coverage program now that really works on improving people's wellness and keeping them healthy, and it's working. It's an economic driver. It's the biggest. This is one thing people always think it's the poor stepchild of the healthcare market. It is one out of five state residents right now. It is the biggest, by huge numbers, the biggest healthcare plan in the state, and we should be treating it that way.
Benita, that's an interesting point, though. This this notion that people perhaps had that it's free health care. Why wouldn't everyone want to take part in it? And the thing that Ellen said that has been so long plaguing Medicaid is the sense that it was very, very hard to see a physician. Has that changed in your mind for the better? Is access more readily available?
I think so in many, many corners, but there still are corners where individuals who have that kind of difficulty. One of the members of our empowerment group, Mothers for Justice, indicated the other day that she had to wait 3 months for a doctor's appointment because his schedule was full. And so it lets me know on that individual basis that there still are places where individuals have difficulty with gaining access and in a timely fashion. And there's much too much still use of the emergency room as a primary point of care. So at the experiential ground level, there still are individuals who use those kinds of opportunities, I guess I'll call them, for healthcare provision. And it's not all that it could be for many of the individuals I serve at CCA.
Could you explain, Commissioner, just who does benefit from Medicaid in Connecticut right now? I mean, what does the population look like by numbers and also by constitution, by makeup?
Sure. We're currently serving about 750,000 Connecticut residents. 400,000 of those are children or adult care providers. We also are right at about 98,000 for our age, blind, and disabled group, and we're close to 200,000 for low-income adults. So our Medicaid program is a really broad, diverse group of individuals needing care. To walk back to the point earlier about providers, we currently have some 33,000 providers for our Medicaid recipients. That's an all-time high, and we're finally paying our primary care providers at the same rate or 100% of Medicare rates, which is an enormous investment in creating those connect points as well as making sure that people have access to the system. We still have some spots. We still need to look to ensure that access is across the board universal and available. But I'm really proud of the program that we've been able to develop over the last 4 or 5 years.
You say 33,000 providers. What would be the target number of providers to adequately, truly serve the population that you need to serve?
That's a really good question, John, which I don't have the answer to. I know that 33,000 is a really solid number. We continue to try and enroll more providers every day. We do something that's very unique. We provide electronic eligibility or enrollment for providers, something very few states do. And we also pay our providers every 2 weeks, unlike any other private provider or private payer. So we make sure that we are doing our work well with the providers because they are the front line in ensuring that our beneficiaries stay well. And that's the most important thing, not just getting access to medical care, but how do you stay well? That's the key.
As we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Medicaid program, we're talking about how it is instituted in Connecticut, how it's changing, what the future is, with Rod Bremby from the Connecticut Department of Social Services, also with Ellen Andrews from the Connecticut Health Policy Project, and Reverend Benita Grubbs from Christian Community Action. I want to bring in Alan Weil from Health Affairs to give us a little bit of a national overview. First of all, Alan, something you've written, Medicaid is a program loved by few, denigrated by many, and misunderstood by most. It's often the target of politicians in need of budget reductions. Do you think that that is still the case in these post-Obamacare years where so many have been added to Medicaid?
I do think it's still the case, and maybe over time we'll see that change, although we've had that hope before. It's an incredibly complex program, as you've already heard from the folks who've been speaking, and the misunderstandings occur both at the state level, but maybe more so among our federal legislators, Congress, where because the program is administered at the state level, it's mostly a budget item at the federal government level. It's not a program that they work with every day, in Congress at least. And so it's hard to have the same level of understanding. It's also a very dynamic program. It's hard to keep up with the changes.
It's obviously hard to keep up with the changes. Your suggestion is that because it's just a budget line item, those in Congress aren't paying as close attention to the real needs on the ground as perhaps they could?
Well, I don't want to criticize them for their attention, but I would just say it's hard to know something that you don't work with on a regular basis. And because the costs of serving 70 million people are quite high, it's an easy target. The only addition I would make to the excellent discussion already is that not just have we seen growth in the program, which we certainly have, but there have been real shifts in who is covered in what kinds of services. More than 40% of Medicaid costs are associated with people with disabilities. I'm talking about people with a traumatic brain injury, children with autism, and as they grow up, they become adults, people with severe persistent mental health, cerebral palsy, a whole host of conditions that when the program began, people with these kinds of disabilities either were undiagnosed or they were placed in institutions or, frankly, many of them had very short lives. Similarly, it's the largest provider of long-term services and supports for elders, who many of whom believe that those needs will be met by Medicare, but they are not. And historically, again, we primarily provided people with nursing home care. Now we're able to keep people in the home and in the community. So the program has not just grown, but it is very active in providing a tremendous spectrum of social and medical needs to truly the most needy people. And although you have to meet an income test to be in the program, if you're middle class and you or a member of your family is afflicted by a serious disability or you need to go into a nursing home, very quickly you become income eligible. So this really is a very program with very broad reach.
So, Ellen, one tricky question around this is it has grown in the way it works and also in the number of people and the types of people who it can provide services to. Is this, in the end, this growth in the services that are provided under Medicaid, is it the most efficient way to provide these services to these people?
Oh, I love this question. Yes.
I thought the you might like this question.
Yes, absolutely. And, yeah, it's an expensive program for all the reasons that Alan talked about, that one of the ways you can get in to the program is having high medical bills. That's a medically needy spend down category. So, yeah, it's going to be an expensive program. But for healthy families in that Husky A program that the commissioner was talking about, the costs are far less than they are in private insurance. Even the cost to the payer – and I hate that term, but the payer is less, even given that people have to pay their own premiums, they have to pay for their out-of-pocket costs. It's still incredibly efficient. Medicaid for the administration is 5% on that average. I'm sure the commissioner knows better than I. But in private market, they're having trouble. They're struggling. They're having to send back rebates because they go over 15 or 20% administrative costs. We're doing an exceptional job in Medicaid. And the population is moving. The Medicaid is growing, and employer-sponsored coverage is shrinking over time in Connecticut and nationally. And it's moving toward a more efficient program that still has problems, no question about it. Benita's right about that. But we're working on them. And honestly, it's hard. We have a primary care shortage, too. Everybody has trouble sometimes getting on.
What's your view on this, Benita?
Well, I was just listening to Ellen talk, and one of the things that I said was, yeah, there have been many good things for an administrative services organization. So we got rid of this sort of mishmash of other kinds of insurance companies providing health care. I mean, I've been on the Medicaid Assistance Program Oversight Council for a few years. And so I've seen the shift in the way that the Department of Social Services has approached the provision of care, from looking around for doctors in certain areas of the state, in the eastern part of the state in particular. And so I'm really pleased with what I've been able to see over time with the changes that have been made in the program and the kind of specialization and attention to those specialized needs, like, you know, people who are disabled, people who are wanting to live in their own homes. So there are a range of things that I've seen over time that I think have been fabulous in the way in which the program has grown. And you know, applaud everything that I think has been done. We've been looking really in particular at how people gain access through the Access Health window and how do people get into the Medicaid system, so that there's some challenges there. But by and large, I think we've really done a very good job of really trying to make sure that this program really does work for families and that the systems are in place to try to create that kind of capacity.
Commissioner, quickly before our break, I'm wondering if you can walk us through some of the challenges of under the Affordable Care Act, adding the large number of Medicaid recipients. So many people signed up. Of course, the notion was that states that decided to expand their Medicaid enrollment would have certainly some people sign up, and we didn't know how many, and we'd have a lot more who are signing up for private insurance. And as it turned out, in some states like Connecticut, there's been a whole lot of people who signed up under Medicaid. Explain some of the challenges and maybe successes of that part.
That's another really good question. I think primarily some of the challenges are geared towards capacity. As Ellen said, our administrative overhead is about 5.4%, which is grossly below what other payers utilize. But in terms of capacity, it's the integration between the two types of participants, people who might go through the exchange for a qualified health product and may even get a subsidy, and also the Medicaid recipient, and going back and forth between systems. We've not routinized that yet. We haven't become really efficient in ensuring to help people make those transitions back and forth. So I think on the horizon, that is the question, that is the challenge that's foremost in the top of my mind. It's how do we make those transitions between systems more seamless?
Alan, I'm wondering if you could just quickly comment on this from the national perspective. Obviously, we've heard many, many stories about how Connecticut's healthcare exchange has worked substantially better than other healthcare exchanges around the country. And in part, the Medicaid enrollment piece of this under the ACA was certainly reflected there. In the United States, however, that hasn't universally been the case. What can you tell us from a national perspective about adding all of these new Medicaid recipients under Obamacare?
Well, we have always had concerns about access to care. There have always been anecdotes, significant anecdotes, about people with delays receiving services. And yet, for many, many years, we've had data showing that on the aggregate, people on Medicaid have pretty good access to care, certainly far, far better than they would if they were uninsured. And one of the challenges is that you really have to compare like to like. The fact is that low-income people with private insurance also tend to have quite poor access to care because they often have high deductibles or the quality of their plans is quite poor, and so they have fewer choices. And so if you compare sort of a middle-class product and people's ability to access care to Medicaid, you're not just comparing plans, you're also actually sometimes looking at different populations. That said, this is a concern around the country. There's good evidence. We just published a paper showing that with the Medicaid expansion in some states, they were actually able to improve access. So a lot of it has to do with payment. And if you pay appropriately, as you've heard discussions of improvements in Connecticut, if you pay appropriately, then as you expand the program, you also expand the willingness of providers to participate. If you simply expand the program and keep some of the historical very low payment levels, those who have already decided there for reasons of their mission that they want to participate in the program, they just get more people showing up at their door, but you don't actually get any more access. And as was just noted, we have limitations of access to primary care in this country for everyone because we pay in commercial insurance and in Medicare, we pay much higher rates to specialists. And so as we're training our doctors, more people go into specialty practice. So Medicaid, as it is this large, it suffers from some of the same ills of the whole healthcare system. Is Medicaid a little fragmented? Yes. Is the healthcare system fragmented? You bet. Does Medicaid have some access constraints? Yes. Does the healthcare system as a whole have them? You bet. So I think it's important not just to look at the problems, but to realize that in many states, Medicaid is participating in broader efforts to improve the whole healthcare system, and that's actually where we need to be.
We're talking today with Alan Weil, who's Editor-in-Chief of Health Affairs. Also joining us in our studio today is Roderick Bremby, who is the Commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Social Services, Ellen Andrews from the Connecticut Health Policy Project, and Reverend Benita Grubbs from the Christian Community Action in New Haven. We're going to take more of your phone calls at 860-275-7266 when we come back as we talk about Medicaid at 50 here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking today about Medicaid. The Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare, made Medicaid the nation's largest single provider of public health insurance. This year, states will pick up some of the cost of the expansion, making reductions tempting within tight budgets. We have a panel of experts talking about Medicaid. Rod Bremby from the DSS and Ellen Andrews from the Health Policy Project here in Connecticut, from Christian Community Action, Reverend Benita Grubbs, and also Alan Weil from Health Affairs. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Let's go to Bill, who's calling from New Haven. Hi there, Bill. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. I've got a question. I live kind of on the edge of commercial insurance through the exchange and Medicaid. I'm right on that boundary. And since I'm self-employed, I really don't know from 1 month to the next, let alone 1 year to the next, what I'm actually going to make. And Medicaid would be a great service to me because even with the subsidized health insurance, it's expensive. But I can't really, it looks like I can't apply for Medicaid if I don't know for sure what I'm going to make each and every month. I mean, 1 month I might make nothing, and the next month make $1,500 or $2,000. So I don't know quite how to apply for Medicaid, even though I'm pretty sure I'll come under the line, because I don't know what I'm making from month to month, which seems to me to be what they ask for in the forms.
Hmm.
Is there some sort of slosh in this?
Well, so, Bill, hang on the line here, because I'm just going to go around our table here and see if – I'll start with the commissioner and see if we can answer your question. I really appreciate your call.
Thank you.
Yeah, Bill, you're expressing one of the concerns and one of the frustrations that I have in trying to ensure that we have this seamless integration between multiple systems. We have some resources that are available online if you want to test out what you're eligible for. The application, electronic application portal can be found at ct.gov/DSS/apply. Also, we have people that can help you walk through the applications. And so if you're not getting any satisfaction in knowing what's the best route, please don't hesitate to give us a call.
Ellen, any thoughts for Bill?
Well, I just heard his word slosh, and I love that. That's a great term. In wonk world, we call it churn, which is also a little graphic. But this is a common problem. Whenever you create a program, you can only afford to go up so high, and unfortunately that came down a little for some groups, so one group this last year. So people do move up and down. I mean, people do not have consistent, stable jobs with, you know, knowing, especially in this economy, people are working freelance, they're working more than one job. It's a common problem. Slosh, however, I'm surprised the commissioner isn't hyperventilating, because the CMS takes a very dim view of us putting people onto Medicaid who might not be eligible. And the reason for that is that this last year they paid 57% of the cost. That's a really important piece, is Connecticut taxpayers paid about I have it here somewhere, but a little over $2 billion, but the feds paid $5.7 billion. Oh, no, they paid in $3.3 billion. So they're paying most of the costs for this program. They want to be pretty sure that we're really reaching people who are eligible, people who should be on Medicaid, and that's basically the reason for the quandary. I know that's no comfort, but that's why he's in that mess that he is.
Benina, any other thoughts for Bill and others like him?
I think we had anticipated in the shift that these kinds of things would happen to individuals, but I think that in those cases, people were encouraged to just see if they could become eligible for the service and to see how we could get the coverage. I mean, it's not the solution that I would like to offer. I'd like to say, yes, you should be able to, but there's a system that is in place, and we have to work within the system. And then where those kinds of problems are identified, that we could actually do something to remedy them.
You hear, and Bill, thank you again. I hope that was helpful. You hear about cases like this all the time. What's the system right now, Benita, for people who have a question, for people who want to find out, am I eligible? Am I going to be kicked off this year, or do I have to file new paperwork this year? I mean, what do we do to help people navigate through this?
Well, that brings up something that's been around the MAPOC table for the last number of months, and that is that individuals can get access through a benefit center, through the DSS office, and online. And when individuals actually had an ability to make a phone call, that there were wait times that far exceeded anyone's expectations. Part of the celebration, I guess I'll call it, at the MAPOC meeting was indeed that we had gotten down to a 22-minute wait time, and I think there's still room to grow. But the department is very, I guess I would say, called on the carpet about the long wait time because individuals who are poor and don't have a lot in the way of resources and have what's called Obama phones with limited minutes had some difficulty trying to get access to the system.
I've not heard Obama phones before.
I didn't either until some of the folks I served mentioned that to me. But that's what they call them because they had limited minutes. And so we at this month's MAPOC meeting, there was actually the report that was given that said that the wait times were actually lovely in a very lovely and heartwarming way reduced to about 17 minutes. Again, there's some more work to be done to try to get that wait time down and other methods, as the commissioner's mentioned, that people can gain access. But that's an area that I think there is some more room to grow. But I celebrate the fact that people don't have to wait 90 minutes. It was about 20 minutes at this point to get access. And in addition to that, it's not just a phone call to the benefit center for Medicaid. It's for a range of other services like food stamps and other kinds of services. So.
The commissioner knows full well I'm going to now turn my head and ask him about these wait times. But before I do, not everyone in our audience knows exactly what MAPOC means.
Oh, the Medicaid Assistance Program Oversight Council. Ellen and I sit on that council.
That's great.
And a number of other individuals from the community health centers, from Legal Assistance Association, a range of different places to really look at what the policy has been over time and how the policy has gone forward. So over the years, there's a legislative appointments, which is how I get to the table as a kind of a consumer advocate. And it's been sometimes frustrating and sometimes a very heartwarming, like this past. It was a warm and fuzzy moment to celebrate Medicaid and to hear about the wait times.
Let's just get to that. Go ahead. Please, Alan, jump in.
If I could just jump in with
a please.
Question. Medicaid in states like yours that have expanded Medicaid and exchange coverage are two puzzle pieces that don't fit together perfectly, but they really should come together quite closely. You should not have to project your future income for a Medicaid application because Medicaid eligibility is not based on future income. And exchange eligibility, subsidy eligibility, is based on annual income, which you do have to project because you don't know what it's going to be. This is a perfect situation where some in-person or telephonic assistance would make sense. But I just want to encourage Bill and others in his circumstances to not think that they have to figure this out. The system is a little cumbersome, there's no question, and I think over time, hopefully, we will figure out how to get these puzzle pieces completely fitting. But there is not he called his slosh term, there should not actually be a gap here. And so the fact that he can't on his own determine what he's eligible for should not dissuade him from seeking assistance. Mm-hmm.
So, Commissioner, I you might want to comment on that, but I do want to ask you about this. You know, we recently did a program we had on R.L. Levin Becker from the Connecticut Mirror, who had been reporting on the wait times. We had her on about a year or so ago, and we had these 90-minute long waits. And not just the 90-minute long waits for calls, but it was a lot of people dropping off before they ever got their call through. Now that has improved, and the actual wait time has improved as well. That all said, it's rare that I would ever hold for 17 minutes for anything. The most important call of my life, I probably would hang up around 15 or 16 minutes and curse. So the question is, how do we get from a lot of progress in long wait times at the DSS to 17 minutes to something that's more approaching what we'd all like to see, which is not waiting very long at all?
Well, this is a question that we've been wrestling with for quite some time. And I think the last time I was here, I was talking about the modernization that the agency had began to launch. We knew that access has been an issue. In fact, when I just arrived, most of the complaints that I got about the agency is that people couldn't get access to anyone anywhere in our offices, or they got access to a voicemail machine and the voicemail box was full. And so we created new telephony access points so that people could call in and get access. So we processed over 1 million phone calls in the last 2 years, which is a phenomenal volume. What we did not do well was describe what this benefit center was all about. And so as anyone would logically conclude, it should be like a call center where I call and someone will pick up that call in seconds. We thought that it would be akin to a mobile office so that when people walk in, they stand in line, they wait, and then they see someone, that would be the comparable. We know better now. We know what our customers are asking for. We've begun to do some business process reengineering, and I think the numbers have dropped to 17 minutes. But that's not the last stage. The next step for us to is identify a tiering structure so that when people call in, they get that quick speed to answer, and then they transfer back to the benefits center so that people can help them at that point in time. But we're evolving. This has been a slow, painful process. We're learning, but we believe that access is far greater than it has ever been before. On call abandonment issue, what we have not done, unlike many other call centers, is regulate at what point do you begin to count that. We count that every second. But when a person calls and hangs up right away, that's abandoned for us. We want to know every call. In some centers, it's a 5-second, 10-second, 30-second threshold before you hang up, and you count that. So we've got some more growth ahead of us. We've got some more improvement ahead of us, but we feel comfortable with where we are right now, and we're going to do our darndest to provide a high-quality service throughout our Medicaid program.
I will have to ask you in just a moment about some changes that may be coming in August that may, again, force another volume of calls. But, Ellen, I asked you a similar question to this earlier when I asked about, is Medicaid the most efficient way to provide all of these services that it now provides? Okay, next question. Is the single portal through the DSS, which also provides so many other services outside of Medicaid, is this the most efficient way to get the types of information, complex information, to people like Bill who might not know if they're eligible? Is this the best way to do it?
Okay, that's a harder answer.
You're not so excited now.
It will be.
Yeah.
It is, I have to say, it's much, much better. And one of the big things, two big things that happened, and I, you know, the commissioner, I think it was his first week of work here in Connecticut. He just started, and I brought him a report, Fixing Medicaid, which had, dozens of pages of problems in the system. And to their credit, they are working through them. And almost all of them, and we looked at what, you know, was working in other states, and he's built on that, you know, thousandfold. That's not to say that there aren't still serious problems, and it's really important that Benita's world connect to the enrollment world, but that also connects to actually once you get into the program, you can actually see somebody. And in that, the real innovation that happened in Connecticut that Alan maybe can talk to, most states are moving toward managed care organizations. Having insurers run it, saying, we just, you know, this is too hard. We can't do this. We're going to, outsource it. Connecticut did that for 15 years, and it wasn't working on a whole bunch of levels. We could do a whole show, about that. But it, the new administration came in and said, you know, this isn't working. Since we have moved back to a fee-for-service system where the department gets all the data, it doesn't go through managed care organizations, and Benita can speak to this. We used to hear about apples and oranges at the Maypot Council and all the fruit orchard and how you could never – it looks bad, but that's just an anecdote or it's not really true. Now we get all the data in one place. They're all apples. Everything's an apple.
So all the data in one place, a better situation than what you had before, Benita?
Oh, by any estimation, it's much better. There were different rates the providers had per person, per member, and a whole lot of confusion and protection of those managed care companies. So the fact that we get all the data, which may not always be to the department's liking, we have an opportunity to really see exactly what's going on and can really look to see, well, things are fine here, but there's some improvement over there. So, yes, it's a much better way of looking comprehensively at the program.
Alan, do you want to chime in quickly on the challenges perhaps faced by other states other than Connecticut on providing some of these services in the way, you know, in the way that we are here or the way that other states have chosen to?
It's very much a state-by-state circumstance. It is true that most states rely heavily on managed care companies to actually organize the care for Medicaid enrollees. Increasingly, they're using those companies as well for more complex populations, people with disabilities, whereas historically it was mostly just for adults and relatively healthy adults and children. A lot of it just depends on how you structure it, what kind of oversight you have. There are many states that use managed care companies, and they do get the data, and they are able to hold those companies accountable. If they don't have that kind of oversight, then you worry about the outcome. I ran the Medicaid agency in Colorado 2 decades ago. We moved into managed care. After I left, they moved out. So these are choices that you make really based on the plans you have in the state, the capacity of the providers, the capacity of the agency to provide oversight, the politics of the managed care plans, and this is a discussion happening all over the country.
I want to ask you quickly, Commissioner, before we have to take our next break. On August 1st, legislation would cut benefits to about 24,000 people who are currently covered. The notion is that many of these people would buy insurance on the state exchange. Can you talk about the impact of this, what exactly is happening on August 1st?
Sure. August 1st begins the first phase of a transition of beneficiaries who had been covered by Medicaid to the exchange for qualified health products there. What we're doing right now is preparing for that by reaching out, providing adequate notification, as well as a point transition so that we can help people know what's available on the other side. As Ellen said, on the other side awaits is a copayment, which may not be received well, but we want to ensure that the plans are or the product is used on the other side so that there's no gap in service or people lost in the system. I think in the last thing that we would want is for folks who are currently Medicaid beneficiaries to go uncovered and not make that transition to the exchange or through the exchange to a qualified health product.
I can only imagine, though, that as we were talking about access to information, access to someone at your call center, that indeed you may see a ramping up of activity around this August 1st date, right? And how are you preparing for that?
That's a great question, John. We're not using that number specifically for those people making the transition. We've identified a number through Access Health, through the Maximus Call Center, which is a privately staffed call center, as well as we're providing or forwarding some of our eligibility policy folks to assist that population as well.
Just so I understand, are the people who are going to be off of Medicaid, are they getting some sort of communication that says,
yes,
now this is who you deal with, this is who you call if you've got questions?
Yes.
Okay, so that's how that's working.
Yes. And again, these folks will not be expected to contact the Benefit Center for that information because it's very unique information for their unique circumstance. So we're going to monitor this very closely because August is the first phase of a much larger transition next year. So we want to make sure that we get this right so it can be applied to a broader population next year.
And Ellen, why is this happening? Why are these 24,000 people losing their coverage?
Money, the budget. And I'm sure this won't come as a shock to the commissioner, but we will be lobbying hard to try and keep about 1,300 people are going to lose it August 1st, but the rest of the 23,000 keep it for a year under federal law, and there are certain hoops and things that this department needs to go through to make sure that people are being appropriately put into that category and maybe should keep it. But the advocates are going to be working really hard to get that money back in the budget so that this doesn't happen.
You're concerned about this, Benita?
Oh, absolutely. And I know that I've got a letter that I've received that was sent to the commissioner from Connecticut Legal Services to really say a couple of things. One is what Ellen just indicated, and also just trying to make sure that people get the information that they need to have and to be helpful to them in whatever way possible. And it is a budgetary decision, and it's unfortunate that it is that, and some people are going to be affected in a negative way as a result of this shift.
Alan, it's a budgetary decision here in Connecticut. I can only imagine this is a similar budgetary situation that's happening in states around the country.
Medicaid is the largest or second largest item in every state budget. What's complicated about it is that it's also the largest source of federal revenue in state budgets. And so any decision about Medicaid has both revenue and cost implications. It also is a great driver of economic growth. Of course, we're a little overinvested in healthcare in this country, and so that is a mixed blessing. And then we have the dynamic that was mentioned at the outset of the show, which is that for the expansion population, the federal taxpayer is picking up the full cost in the early years, but states start picking up a share as time goes forward. So it's impossible to get through a legislative session in any state that I can think of without there being a discussion of the Medicaid budget.
When we, Ellen, cut at the state level because we have to cut because of our state budget, how much federal money are we leaving on the table?
For every dollar we cut, we are leaving 57 cents on the table. It's a really penny-wise, pound-foolish cut. The other thing that Alan alluded to in his journal article was published around Connecticut's expansion of Medicaid and how that reduced uncompensated care at hospitals, the number of people showing up who couldn't pay their bills. And that's a cost. The hospitals still need to keep their lights on. And we had a conversation about hospital financing and CEOs' salaries. They're still going to pay the people they need to. So those costs are going to be shifted on to everyone else. Just because somebody loses coverage doesn't mean they stop needing health care. So there are a lot of ways that this was not the right it was a bad policy, and advocates will be working hard to reverse it.
Commissioner?
Yeah, not to argue the point, but just to be clear, although federal dollars would not come to the state for Medicaid reimbursement, federal dollars would come to the state to enable subsidized private insurance policies to be acquired. So it's not a net-net loss of federal funding coming into the state. It's the different tranche through which those dollars are allocated. Looking over the next year, though, we are committed to looking for any and all savings that we can find within the Medicaid program. What we're proud to say about this current Medicaid program is because we're structured in a different way, we're managed fee-for-service organization, which is fully at risk, we're able to use data in ways that we've not used data before. We can apply predictive analytics to identify where cost structures may be exhibited. But we also can do a risk stratification, which we've done, to make sure that people who are most in need get the unique intensive care management that they so need in order to stay well or to get back to some state of wellness. Every state has a 50-50 or 550 concern issue, 5% of the population driving 50 to 60% of the costs. We're going to be focusing on the group of the population that drives those costs but also need more care. What we've been able to see since we've started our intensive care management is significant reductions in utilization and cost. For ED visits, people who participate in our intensive care management program, we've seen our costs go down by 30%, utilization go down by 32%. Inpatient admissions have dropped by half, and a 41% reduction in cost for that population that we can get our arms around. So as we become a more effective Medicaid program, we fully expect to see some savings, which hopefully can be translated into a more robust approach.
And the more you provide those savings and the more you innovate and change, the better case, I think, the two advocates here would say that you should be providing care to more people, not fewer.
That's the case that they would make, and we're going to make the case that we're going to try to get to a healthier population.
We're talking today about Medicaid. It's celebrating 50 years this year. We're talking about how it works here in Connecticut. When we come back from our break, we'll take some more of your phone calls, and we'll talk more about some of the costs. And as we continue our conversation, join us here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Tomorrow on the program, two conversations. The first with the state child advocate about a new report on the treatment of children in state custody. The second with a Yale professor who is on a presidential advisory commission on policing in America. I hope you can join us for those conversations here on Where We Live. Today on the program, we're talking about Medicaid at 50, how it's changed, what it means for people here in Connecticut. We're joined by Roderick Bremby, who is the Connecticut Department of Social Services Commissioner, Ellen Andrews, who is the Executive Director of the Connecticut Health Policy Project, Reverend Benita Grubbs, who is Executive Director of Christian Community Action in New Haven, and Alan Weil, who is Editor-in-Chief of Health Affairs. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. We're getting a call from Sheldon in New Haven. Sheldon Taubman?
Yes. Hi.
Hi. I thought this might be you. How are you? What's your thought?
Well, as you know, I'm a Medicaid advocate as well, and I'm calling because folks are talking about Medicaid as a success and pointing out the commissioner noted that there's about a 5.4% administrative cost for the Medicaid program, which is really great around the country. But not only that, we also have an incredible low trend for medical inflation. If you compare it to the states around the country that have managed care organizations, they are seeing much higher rates of inflation. In fact, at one point, we had a negative growth in the per member per month cost of the program once we got rid of the managed care organizations. And related to that, I did also want to briefly mention, Alan had said that in some states with good monitoring, it's possible to get the data. I am in contact with my colleagues around the country, and they find that to be an extremely difficult challenge. And I think the reason why it's been so difficult, as based in our experience in Connecticut, managed care organizations, when they're there, have a lot of political power. and they tend to use that power to withhold information and threaten to leave if, you know, too much pressure is put on them. We had a lot of fights over that over the years under the Freedom of Information Act, et cetera. And basically, until we replaced them with an efficient, unitary administrative service organization, there was really no way to ensure on an ongoing basis access to the kind of data we're now getting, which can really make the program improve even more. So I just wanted to mention that as well.
Sheldon, thank you very much for your phone call. Before we run too low on time, another function of the bad budget experience that we're having here in Connecticut, the permanent state of fiscal crisis, as it's been called. There's also a call for a reduction of 42.5% in reimbursement to doctors in the upcoming budget. We've talked about the very high, at least on a national level, Rod Bremby, that Connecticut has for reimbursing doctors. What is happening with reimbursement rates?
Gosh, that's an interesting stat. I think it may be a little off. The primary care providers will continue to see 100% of Medicare costs. We did have fee reductions in some specialty line items, but I think if you look at those nationally or even regionally, those are competitive. So there, that 42% was not gross or overall, but maybe to a subset of the provider population.
That's a number that I saw in a number of studies. Can you flesh that out for us any more, Ellen?
I think it went back and forth, and I don't remember exactly where it landed. But there were some very significant cuts proposed, and there were cuts happening even before the budget happened that were, you know, historic and still budget related, but not in the latest budget. So it's an ongoing thing. I think, and it's, you know, obviously, if you pay people less, they're going to see fewer of our clients. That's a problem. But I think. Another big issue, though, is not just the rates. There, you know, providers, especially primary care providers, they can fill their DMS card anytime they want. And they take Medicaid patients because they believe in it. They care about it. It's why they went into medicine. And, you know, they can't take too many because you still need to keep your lights on. But they're doing it for the right reasons. And we have to make it as good an experience for them and as possible for them to do just the job that they need to, so they're not dealing with a lot of administrative hassles, which we've been able to do with the shift that Sheldon talked about. And also patient-centered medical homes, which is another program that we're paying more for to help coordinate care. And that's made a big difference in access to care. And also, quality has improved in this program. And the number of providers, since we did that shift that Sheldon talked about, the number of providers in this program is up 32%. That's awesome, which is really good because we just added 130,000 more people.
I was going to say, so more providers, and Ellen is suggesting, Benita, that it's not just about how much you pay, but it's about making sure that it's not such a paperwork hassle that it costs you a lot of money in that way too.
Well, that's true. It also has an effect on the consumer. And so if there is less accessibility, then there's less opportunity for a person to get care on a timely basis. And so there's an advantage, I think, to being able to maintain a rate and reduce the number of kinds of problems or challenges that people face in trying to get access.
And we just have about 30 seconds left, Commissioner. Sure. Please go ahead.
So within the program, we're trying to be extremely mindful. Medicaid programs are sitting on this interesting precipice. If we were able to reduce expenditures, that means someone else is losing revenue. So we have to be careful about how our expenditures are truncated so that we're making reductions in the most reasonable places. We need to look for efficiencies. We need to make sure that in our long-term services and supports, we're able to provide person-centered care at the home rather than a facility. And our rebalancing, people who should not be in long-term care facilities should be afforded the opportunity for care in the community. So it's all those types of innovations and opportunities that we thrive for, that we look for in helping to build out quality access and also bending the cost curve in our Medicaid program.
Commissioner Bremby and Reverend Grubbs, Ellen Andrews and Alan Weil, thank you all for joining us. I really appreciate this conversation. We'll keep it going online at WNPR.org/Where We Live. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Our program produced today by Betsy Kaplan with Heather Brandon and Katie Tolarski, the executive producer. I'm John Dankowski. This is Where We Live.